Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
If not everyone in your community feels welcome, our business is going to want to move here if we don't have those kind of protections in place.
Alaska's first openly LGBTQ lawmakers prepare to head to Juneau. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, plans for a power and internet cable to Metlakatla get a boost in federal funding.
It's our first step towards, one of our first steps towards, you know, making lives, affordable and livable for our residents.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is still neck and neck with her right-wing challenger Republican Kelly Chewbacca after thousands of additional ballots were tallied this afternoon. Chewbacca leads by about 1,500 votes. Murkowski's share is likely to grow once Democrat Pat Chesbro, who finished third in last week's election, is eliminated during the ranked choice process. Incumbent Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy has maintained his lead with 51% of the vote. He still appears on track to secure a second term. And Democrat Mary Peltola still holds a strong lead in the race for Alaska's lone seat in the U.S. House with about 48% of the vote. Of course, this only includes first-choice votes. All races where no candidate has more than 50% of the vote will head to ranked choice tabulation on Wednesday, November 23rd, bringing finality to a long election season. The Division of Elections is expected to add more first-choice ballots to the count tonight, and we will continue to update the tallies at alaskapublic.org. In its more than 60-year history, Alaska has never had an openly LGBTQ state lawmaker. After this year's general election, voters are set to send 3 to Juneau. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on how the history-making candidates hope to better reflect the state's diversity in the legislature.
Democrat Andrew Gray assumed he'd feel relieved after seeing he got more than 50% of the vote, enough to win his race outright and represent East Anchorage in the state house. But a little over a week later, with more results trickling in and confirming his win, he's still a little anxious.
There's been meetings and phone calls and trying to, you know, figure out where I'm going to live and thinking about staff to hire. And all of that has been stressors that I was not expecting and that have continued to prevent me from sleeping well at night.
While Gray says he's laser-focused on the issues he campaigned on, his win also notches a big milestone in Alaska politics. He and two other candidates, Jenny Armstrong and Ashley Carrick, are on track to become the first openly LGBTQ Alaskans to serve in the state legislature. But all three candidates, including Gray, say while representation is important, it's not why they ran.
That is not a part of my campaign. I ran on housing and homelessness. I ran on fully funding our schools. I ran on bringing common sense solutions to the problems that we have in our community. And it just happens to be that I am married to a man.
Gray lives in East Anchorage with his husband, Jay, and their 9-year-old son. Gray is a member of the National Guard, and he worked at the VA for 5 years before running for office. Even though Gray will be the first openly gay man to serve in Juneau, he says he knows that journey of representation didn't start and end with him. He speaks highly of former Anchorage Senator Johnny Ellis, who publicly came out in 2016 after retiring from more than 30 years of public service. Ellis passed away earlier this year. Gray thinks public sentiments have changed, so much so that he felt comfortable putting his husband on his campaign handouts.
Our Get Out the Vote mailer actually had a photo of our family, of me and my husband and my son on it. I am someone running in 2022. I don't think this race, the way I did it, would have been possible even 10 years ago.
Also in Anchorage, Democrat Jenny Armstrong, who's poised to win her West Anchorage House seat, identifies as pansexual, and she says she represented herself fully in her campaign.
You know, it was a big banner on my website. It is nothing that I ever hid. For me, I really believe that when folks feel fully self-expressed and can be who they are and feel safe and seen and heard and loved, that those are not just nice ideas, but that they're connected to a thriving economy.
Armstrong is the founder of two businesses aimed at promoting social good and philanthropy, especially among women. As one of the first openly LGBTQ lawmakers, Armstrong wants constituents to feel welcomed and represented by their government.
If not everyone in your community feels welcome, are businesses going to want to move here if we don't have those kind of protections in place? Are we going to attract people to want to move to Alaska? More importantly, are folks going to want to stay?
Further north, Democrat Ashley Carrick, a former legislative staffer, is slated to win her race to represent Western Fairbanks in the state house. Carrick is openly bisexual and says she's been out for all of her adulthood.
Growing up as a teenager and feeling the need to be closeted myself, to now being really openly a public figure and LGBT, I think that representation is important, and I bring a certain mindfulness on those issues that comes from experience to the table.
One of the LGBTQ issues that Carrick says could come up in the legislature is gay marriage, which is currently federally protected.
Our Constitution specifically states that marriage is between a man and a woman, so if the Supreme Court decides to overturn that, we're going to have a major challenge in this state. So as someone who not only cares about LGBT friends who are married and same-sex relationships, but as someone who could have easily been that person, I think that that's really important to me.
As Carrick, Gray, and Armstrong prepare to join 57 other lawmakers in Juneau next year, they say they're very aware that not every lawmaker will be open to their sexual orientation. For example, the state Republican Party has taken stances against gay marriage and recognition of transgender youth. Carrick says she believes that everyone who runs for public office does so with the best intentions. While she says it's disappointing that there are lawmakers who intend to govern in opposition to her identity, she hopes she can bridge those divides.
If you come into it knowing that people are trying their best based on the values and beliefs that they have, then you can start to address some of those values and beliefs on a more empathetic and productive level than just sort of writing certain colleagues off. And I would hope that they would do the same with me.
Pending any drastic changes to the election results, Gray, Carrick, and Armstrong will be sworn in as members of Alaska's 33rd legislature in January. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Businesses spent more than $5 million on leases to explore for oil on state-owned territory in the Arctic, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources announced last week. The Alaska Beacon reports that the annual North Slope lease sale drew the majority of the high bid total at $4.5 million, with a simultaneous Beaufort Sea sale drawing about $600,000 in bids. The $4.5 million ranks as one of the least lucrative total dollar figures since lease sales began, though last year was much lower at less than $500,000 in high bids. Among the active bidders were Oil Search Alaska LLC, which picked up tracts near the western North Slope, and Great Bear Petroleum Ventures, which picked up tracts south of Prudhoe Bay. More oil and gas lease sale results are expected by the end of the year. Under a provision of the Inflation Reduction Act, a federal Cook Inlet lease sale that was canceled earlier this year for lack of industry interest was resurrected. That sale must be held by year's end, according to the law, even though recent history shows very little industry interest in offshore oil and gas exploration in Cook Inlet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Molly of Denali gets nominated for two Emmys.
We're dealing with racism, we're dealing with identity, we're dealing with really serious Alaska Native issues, but in the context of educating small children.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The polls have closed on the November 8th general election. Preliminary results have been released online by the Alaska Division of Elections. Final results will not be posted until Wednesday, November 23rd, giving time for all ballots postmarked by Election Day to be counted, including mail ballots from rural Alaska, from college students in the lower 48, and from Alaskans serving in the military abroad. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
Geologists say a spruce tree may have triggered the destructive urban landslide that destroyed homes in Juneau this September. Local naturalists say there's more to the tree than how it died. KTOO's Claire Strempel has the story.
The tree fell in a storm and slid more than 600 feet down the shoulder of Mount Roberts before crashing through a few houses and taking out a power line. It knocked one home off its foundation, flipped a pickup, and triggered an evacuation alert for the neighborhood. The slide was over in a few seconds, but when Juneau naturalist Steve Murley looks at the slice of the tree, called a cookie, he sees a much longer story.
That's a calendar.
Murley and naturalist Richard Karstensen have the cookie in Murley's woodshed, fittingly. The tree's rings tell us it was likely older than the United States. It sprouted and took root on the steep mountainside during the Little Ice Age, sometime in the 1700s. That's back when Okhotsk, the Mendenhall Glacier, extended about 5 more miles, and the Gastineau Channel was choked with icebergs. But the rings show a lot more than the tree's age. Karstensen points to one side of the oblong cookie.
The first thing we noticed was, if this is the center, that the rings are way bigger here. And a conifer tree
that space
on a steep hill is almost always leaning out, like in this case toward the channel. And when they lean, they over time get thicker rings on the lower side.
The rings tell us the tree lived on a steep slope and also tell us a little about its life there. There's a dark spot in the trunk where a rock likely bashed the tree. According to the rings, it took almost 3 decades to fully heal. It's not the only evidence of abuse either. The rings knit around other dark spots, all on the uphill side of the tree. But Karstensen says old trees like this one can actually thrive on Juneau's steep slopes.
This is what people call the Barron's Path.
This is a known avalanche path behind a Juneau neighborhood. The little trees are a giveaway, mostly alders and low brush. But Karstensen points out a huge spruce.
I call this the brave outlier because it sits out and right in the firing line. And I'm guessing it's at least 300 years old.
The spruce is really thick. Karstensen calls it refuge diameter. In other words, there's safety in its girth. There aren't many other trees around it because anything too much smaller gets toppled or buried in snow in regular avalanches.
And you walk over it and you go, how did this thing survive?
He says there are even more trees like this up high. It turns out big trees can do well on steep hillsides, especially in the rocky soil around Juneau that's coarser than soil in a valley and full of boulders.
And that's optimum for rooting strength. Those tree roots get to go way down.
Karstensen says the deep water table on a very steep hillside also helps because trees will send their roots down further. He points out a hemlock that would be inconspicuous if there wasn't a huge bald eagle nest in its crown.
See the nest?
It's about 5 feet thick at the base. Karstensen says it's easily 1,000 years old.
If we were to core that hemlock, I can guarantee you that the outer foot would have 300 rings.
It's thrived for a millennium at the bottom of a slide path. The spruce that came down on Gastineau Avenue is a fraction of that age. By Karstensen's measure, it died in its prime. Trees like that one can live to easily 800 years. There's no definitive answer to what took it down. It could have been high winds or saturated soil that gave way. The base of the trunk was rotten, according to city officials. Most of the tree was hauled to the dump, but what's left rests not far from where it sprouted, between the now mangled houses on Gastineau Avenue. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
One of Petro Marine Services' fuel tanks in Skagway failed on Thursday night, releasing hundreds of gallons of fuel into the company's containment area on the Ore Peninsula. Company representatives said the containment measures worked as planned and no fuel escaped, except for a fine mist that was blown south in heavy winds. KHNS's Mike Swayze reports.
A little before 9 p.m. on Thursday night, Skagway police officer Rick Ackerman was on his normal patrol route when he noticed an unusual mist as he drove past Petro Marine Services tank farm. He smelled fuel and immediately contacted plant manager Tim Cochran. Cochran, along with several employees, responded immediately. He said the containment measures worked as designed.
There's no danger to health or people. It's all contained. We have an impervious liner. It held everything that came out of the tank, and most all of it is back into the tanks.
The containment area has walls that are several feet high around the tank farm and is coated with an ultra-thick epoxy liner that fuel will not seep through. It is designed to contain 110% of the contents of the largest tank on the premises. Skagway police noticed a pool of fuel within that containment area that appeared to be a couple of feet deep at its deepest point on Thursday night. By Friday afternoon, most of that fuel had been secured in another tank. With winds gusting up to nearly 30 miles an hour on Thursday, it's difficult to determine how far the fuel mist traveled. The smell of diesel fuel near the tank farm was thick as of Friday afternoon. The leak was likely caused by a valve that may have malfunctioned, though company representatives are still investigating the cause. Cochrane says the fuel is probably still usable. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says soil from the surrounding area will be tested and remediated if necessary. Petromarine Services was closed on Friday, but plans to reopen by Saturday for regular business. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Mike Swayze.
A long-planned cable connecting Metlakatla and Ketchikan took a big step towards becoming a reality yesterday. The Biden administration announced a $10.4 million grant to fund a 2-mile undersea cable carrying power and broadband internet service to Alaska's only native reservation. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, local leaders say they hope it'll make Metlakatla a better place to live and work.
The $10.4 million grant comes from the Department of Commerce's National Telecommunications and Information Administration and is funded by last year's bipartisan infrastructure law. Keolani Booth is the chairman of Metlakatla Power and Light, the local utility on Annette Island. He says the cable will serve a dual purpose.
It's a cable that has both the broadband and the electricity. And then that'll bring the broadband into town and to all the households and get the first parts of the infrastructure for setting it up for everyone and getting it so our utility can run the broadband to the homes.
The federal agency says the connection will benefit almost 600 homes and businesses in Metlakatla. Once broadband service comes online, he says he expects a big boost for the local schools and the clinic, as well as students who are learning remotely. And he says it'll also be a boon for local businesses.
What we're hoping for is to start creating some jobs at home.
The new broadband connection will enable speeds of up to 1 gigabit per second for both uploads and downloads, according to a grant announcement. That's 40 times faster than the top speed currently available in Metlakatla and on par with what's available in cities like Ketchikan, Anchorage, and Seattle. Booth says about 1,500 tribal members live in Metlakatla, and he says he hopes it'll encourage others who have left the community to return.
It's our first step towards, one of our first steps towards, you know, making lives affordable and livable for our residents here in Metlakatla so they can stay here. You know, I mean, it's very expensive to be where we are.
He also thinks it'll strengthen the ties between Metlakatla and Ketchikan, thanks to the power sales agreement recently greenlit by the Ketchikan City Council.
That'll give us the ability to, through our sales agreement to purchase power, any hydropower or whatever they have. And then the same from our end, and just start being a good partner. You know, it's one thing about being Alaskan is that you're always there for each other.
Metlakatla's mayor, Albert Smith, says that the agreement is huge.
That just happened and got signed. So for this news to come out shortly after that was completed, it's just a really big deal for Metlakatla.
The cable is expected to be installed sometime in the next 2 to 3 years, though Booth cautions that the supply chain issues and other roadblocks could delay the project. Faster speeds would be available shortly after the cable is completed. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Soldotna lost its Planned Parenthood branch in May after 3 decades of local reproductive care from the organization. Today, the nearest Planned Parenthood is 3 hours away in Anchorage. But starting today, a new low-cost reproductive health care option is available on the Central Kenai Peninsula. Homer-based Ketchikan Bay Family Planning Clinic is piloting a program that will bring twice-monthly services to the area. Claudia Haynes is the clinic's CEO.
Really, our remote services initiative as a whole is designed to bring reproductive health services where people need us. And that certainly changed a little bit as the Planned Parenthood Health Center in Soldotna closed last May.
The clinic offers sexual and reproductive health care services, including breast cancer screenings, birth control consulting, fertility counseling, and STI treatment, as well as HIV prevention services and gender-affirming hormone care. Haynes says some patients have been seeing specialists remotely through Planned Parenthood's telehealth system.
But we also had been hearing from Central Peninsula residents that were traveling even to Homer or talking to us about the need for in-person care.
Ketchikan Bay Family Planning Clinic isn't entirely the same as Planned Parenthood. It doesn't offer abortion care services, for example, and it's an independent operation. The organization accepts private insurance and Medicaid. Patients who aren't on insurance will pay what they can on a sliding scale. Dozens of Unalaska residents gathered at the island's airport on Wednesday to welcome Aleutian Airways' first commercial flight. The new regional airline brings promise of more stable and accessible air service to the remote Aleutian Island, but as KUCB's Maggie Nelson reports, it's not clear yet whether it will solve Unalaska's crisis of rising airfare costs.
For the first time since the early 2000s, there will be competition on Unalaska's runway.
Strongest link in the chain is here.
Frank Kelty is the island's former mayor and a contractor for Aleutian Airways, a new regional airline. He was one of about 15 passengers aboard the airline's inaugural flight from Anchorage that landed at Unalaska's Tom Madsen Airport Wednesday morning.
We're going to have a dependable, fast service to Unalaska. This morning we made it in 2 hours flat, left at 7:30 and got here at 9:30. We're going to do our best to provide a great service, and we look forward to working with the community.
The new regional carrier, which is operated by Sterling Airways, will offer daily flights Monday through Friday on its Saab 2000 aircraft, which is a high-speed turboprop plane that holds around 50 passengers. Unalaska has had a fraught relationship with air travel over the past few years. In the fall of 2019, the same kind of aircraft, a Saab 2000, crashed at the end of the runway, killing one passenger in a commercial flight. That sparked a hailstorm of unreliable and expensive air service to and from the island. Prior to Wednesday, Raven Alaska was the only airline offering scheduled commercial flights to Anchorage. Passengers could either fork out the cash for a charter flight or fly on one of Raven's De Havilland Dash 8 planes. Those are slower flights on smaller planes. Alaska Airlines stopped flying jets to Unalaska in 2004, and since then, there's been only one commercial airline offering service between Unalaska and Anchorage at any one time. For Denise Rankin, it's a breath of fresh air to see the Aleutian Airways Puffin logo hanging above Unalaska's check-in counter.
I think it brings some hope to community members that eventually the prices might come down to where they could travel more and bring some stability back, I hope.
Rankin grew up on the island. Now she's the president of the local Native Corporation. She's used to limited air travel options. Still, until recently, she says she hadn't left the island for about 4 years.
But having a larger flight that can carry your bags with you is really important, and I'm hoping that it will bring down some of the air flights' prices. The airfare was one of the main reasons we weren't traveling. It was really expensive.
City officials say the skyrocketing costs of local airfare are pushing people out of the community, jeopardizing the future of Unalaska. But competition doesn't necessarily mean costs will drop. A one-way ticket off the island will still put a pretty nice ding in your wallet. Generally, it'll cost between $650 to almost $1,000 per ticket on the new airline. That's pretty much identical to what Raven Alaska has been charging for the past several months. Aleutian Airways CEO Wayne Heller says he's not sure what prices will look like going forward.
A, a,
a myriad of different things that go into running an airline are a lot more costly than they once were. So there's a level that you have to get to in order to be able to provide service. A lot will depend on, you know, what our load factors are in and out of Dutch. We'll adjust from there.
As for the question that is likely on many locals' minds, will the new airline allow travelers to use their Alaska Airlines miles to buy Aleutian Airways flights? Heller says, maybe, eventually.
It's something on our long-term plans.
Flights on the Saab 2000 aircraft are about an hour shorter than on Raven's Dash 8s, and there's more room for passengers and baggage. Heller says he is excited for the company to take this first big step.
Couldn't be happier. I couldn't be happier. I'm grinning from ear to ear.
And the few dozen folks that came to see the inaugural landing seem to agree with Heller's enthusiasm. In Unalaska, I'm Maggie Nelson.
Molly of Denali has been nominated for 2 Children's and Family Emmy Awards. Vera Starbart is one of the show's writers. She says that Molly of Denali is special to her because of its role informing young people about what it means to be Alaska Native.
We're dealing with racism. We're dealing with identity. We're dealing with really serious Alaska Native issues. But in the context of educating small children, there's just an inherently fun thing about that.
Starbart says the Emmy nomination makes her think about how people outside the state value the show.
Alaskans in general kind of do that to themselves, you know, like we love what we put out there into the world, but we don't think anyone else will take it as seriously or care about it. And this shows people will. People do.
Frank Henry Kosh-Katas is another writer for the show who is listed on the Emmy nomination. Writing for a children's show means he can help create representation he didn't have as a kid.
When I was little, I thought the Ultimate Warrior, the professional wrestler, was a Native guy because I just didn't have any representation that I knew of in the media. Turns out he's like Italian from New Jersey, but that, like, when I was little, I was like, that guy is Tlingit. You know, when I was a little kid, I was like, he's a Tlingit. He wasn't. But, I was grasping at straws at that point.
This is the first year of the Children's and Family Emmys. The nominations were announced early in November, and the winners will be announced next month. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and that's where we'll be updating election results this evening. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George, Liz Ruskin, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Claire Strempel and Yvonne Crumery in Juneau, Mike Swayze in Skagway, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Maggie Nelson in Unalaska. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.